smashing rackets in them. His name was Jimmy Connors, and his biggest fan was Jeff Johnson. Connors, Johnson told me, was the tennis version of Pree. Intense, rebellious, iconoclastic. He urged me to reach out to Connors, sign him to an endorsement deal fast. Thus, in the summer of 1974, I phoned Connors' agent and made my pitch. We'd sign Nastase for $10,000, I said, and we were willing to offer his boy half that. The agent jumped at the deal. Before Connors could sign the papers, however, he left the country for Wimbledon. Then, against all odds, he won Wimbledon in our shoes. Next, he came home and shocked the world by winning the U.S. Open. I was giddy. I phoned the agent and asked if Connors had signed those papers yet. We wanted to get started promoting him.
What papers? The agent said. The papers. We had a deal, remember?
Yeah, I don't remember any deal. We've already got a deal 3 times better than your deal, which I don't remember. Disappointing, we all agreed, but oh well. Besides, we all said, we've still got Pree. We'll always have Pree.
1975. Pay Nisho first. This was my morning chant, my nightly prayer, my number one priority. And it was my daily instruction to the man who played the Sundance Kid to my Butch Cassidy, Hayes. Before paying back the bank, I said, before paying back anyone, pay Nisho. It wasn't so much a strategy as a necessity. Nisho was like equity. Our line of credit at the bank was $1 million, but we had another million in credit with Nisho, which willingly took second position, which made the bank feel more secure. All of this would unspool, however, if Nisho weren't there. Ergo, we needed to keep Nisho happy. Always, always pay Nisho first. It wasn't easy, however, this paying Nisho first. It wasn't easy paying anyone. We were undergoing an explosion in assets and inventory, which put enormous strains on our cash reserves. With any growth company, this is the typical problem. But we were growing faster than the typical growth company, faster than any growth company I knew of. Our problems were unprecedented, or so it seemed. I was also partly to blame, of course. I refused to even consider ordering less inventory. Grow or die, that's what I believed, no matter the situation. Why cut your order from $3 million down to $2 million if you believed in your bones that the demand out there was for $5 million? So I was forever pushing my conservative bankers to the brink, forcing them into a game of chicken. I'd order a number of shoes that seemed to them absurd, a number we'd need to stretch to pay for, and I'd always just barely pay for them in the nick of time, and then just barely pay our monthly bills at the last minute, always doing just enough and no more to prevent the bankers from booting us. And then, at the end of the month, I'd empty our accounts to pay Nisho and start from zero again. To most observers, this would have seemed a brazenly, reckless, dangerous way of doing business. But I believe the demand for our shoes was always greater than our annual sales. Besides, 8 of every 10 orders were solid gold, guaranteed thanks to our futures program. Full speed ahead. Others might have argued that we didn't need to fear Nisho. The company was our ally, after all. We were making them money. How mad could they get? Also, I had a strong personal relationship with Sumeragi. But suddenly in 1975, Sumeragi was no longer running things. Our account had grown too big for him. Our credit was no longer his call alone. Blue Ribbon was now overseen by the West Coast credit manager, Chiyo Suzuki, who was based in Los Angeles, and even more directly by the financial manager of the Portland office, Tadayuki Ito. Everybody at Blue Ribbon liked Sumeragi. We invited him to every office party. Whereas Sumeragi was warm and approachable, Ito was congenitally aloof. Light seemed to bounce off him differently. No, rather, light didn't bounce off him. He absorbed it like a black hole.
In my mind, I called him the Iceman. I still had difficulty making eye contact with people, but Ito wouldn't allow me to divert my gaze. He looked directly into my eyes, down into my soul, and it was hypnotizing. Especially when he felt he had the upper hand. I'd played golf with him once or twice, and I was struck, even after he'd hit a terrible shot, at the way he turned and looked straight at me as he came off the tee. He wasn't a good golfer, but he was so confident, so self-assured, he always gave the impression that his ball was sitting 350 yards away, atop a tuft of grass in the center of the fairway. And now I remember this in particular. His golf attire, like his business attire, was impeccable. Mine, of course, was not. During one of our matches, the weather was cool, and I was wearing a shaggy mohair sweater. As I approached the first tee, Ito asked under his breath if I planned to go skiing later. I stopped, wheeled. He gave me half a smile. It was the first time I'd ever known the Iceman to try humor. And the last. This was the man I needed to keep happy. It wouldn't be easy. But I thought, always do well in his eyes and credit will continue to expand, thus enabling Blue Ribbon to expand. Stay in his good graces and all will be well. Otherwise. My obsession with keeping Nisho happy, with keeping Ito happy, combined with my refusal to ease up on growth, created a frantic atmosphere around the office. We struggled to make every payment, to Bank of California, to all our other creditors, but that Nisho payment at the end of the month was like passing a kidney stone. As we'd begin scraping together our available cash, writing checks with barely enough to cover them, we'd start to sweat. The Nisho payment was sometimes so big that we'd be dead broke for a day or two. Then every other creditor would have to wait. Too bad for them, I tell Hayes. I know, he'd say, pay Nisho first. Hayes didn't like this state of affairs. It was hard on his nerves. So what do you want to do, I asked him. Slow down? Which would always draw a guilty smile, silly question. Occasionally, when our cash reserves were really stretched thin, our account at the bank wouldn't just be empty, it would be overdrawn. Then Hayes and I would have to go down to the bank and explain the situation to Holland. We'd show him our financial statements, point out that our sales were doubling, that our inventory was flying out the door. Our cash flow situation, we'd say, is merely temporary. We knew, of course, that living on the float wasn't the way to do things. But we'd always tell ourselves, it's temporary. Besides, everyone did it. Some of the biggest companies in America lived on the float. Banks themselves lived on the float. Holland acknowledged as much. Sure, boys, I get it, he'd say with a nod. As long as we were upfront with him, as long as we were transparent, he could work with us. And then came that fateful rainy day. A Wednesday afternoon. The spring of 1975. Hayes and I found ourselves staring into the abyss. We owed Nisho $1 million. Our first ever $1 million payment. And, hello, we didn't have $1 million lying around. We were about $75,000 short. I recall that we were sitting in my office, watching raindrops race down the window pane. Occasionally, we'd look through the books, curse the numbers, then look back at the raindrops. We have to pay Nisho, I said quietly. Yes, 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 Hayes said, but to cover a check this large, we'll have to drain all our other bank accounts dry. All dry. Yes. We had retail stores in Berkeley, Los Angeles, Portland, New England, each with its own bank account. We'd have to empty them all, divert all that money to the home office account for a day or two, or three, along with every cent from Johnson's factory in Exeter. We'd have to hold our breath, like walking past a graveyard, until we could replenish those accounts. And still, we might not be able to cover that massive check to Nisho. We'd still need a little luck. A payment or two to land from one of the many retailers who owed us money. Circular funding, Hayes said. Magical banking, I said. Son of a bitch, Hayes said. If you look at our cash flow over the next 6 months, we're in good shape. It's just this one payment to Nisho that's screwing up everything.
Yes, I said, if we can get past this one payment, we're home free.
But this is some payment.
We've always covered checks to Nisho within a day or two, but this time it might take us, what, 3, 4?
I don't know, Hayes said. I honestly don't know.
I followed 2 raindrops racing down the glass, neck and neck.
You are remembered for the rules you break.
Damn the torpedoes, I said. Pay Nisho.
Hayes nodded.
He stood.
We looked at each other for 1 long second.
He said he'd tell Carol Fields, our head bookkeeper, what we decided.
He'd have her start moving the money around.
And come Friday, he'd have her cut the check to Nisho.
These are the moments, I thought.
2 days later, Johnson was in his new office at the Exeter factory, doing paperwork, when a mob of angry workers suddenly appeared at his door.
Their paychecks had bounced, they said. They wanted answers.
Johnson, of course, had no answers to give. He implored them to hold on. There must be some mistake. He phoned Oregon, reached Fields, and told her what was happening. He expected her to say it was all a big misunderstanding, an accounting error. Instead, she whispered, "Oh, shit," then hung up on him. A partition wall separated Fields' office from mine. She ran around the wall and up to my desk.
"You better sit down," she blurted.
"I am sitting down," I said.
"It's all hitting the fan," she said.
"What is?"
"The checks, all the checks."
I called in Hayes. By then he weighed 330 pounds, but he seemed to be shrinking before me as Fields described to us every particular of the Johnson phone call.
"We might have really fucked up this time," he said.
"What do we do?" I said.
"I'll call Holland," Hayes said.
Minutes later, Hayes came back to my office, holding up his hands. "Holland says it's fine. No worries. He'll smooth things over with his bosses."
I sighed. Disaster averted.
In the meantime, however, Johnson wasn't waiting for us to get back to him. He phoned his local bank and learned that his account, for some reason, was bone dry. He called in Giampietro, who drove up the road to see an old friend, a man who owned a local box company. Giampietro asked the man for a loan of $5,000, cash, an outrageous request. But the man's box company depended on Blue Ribbon for its survival. If Blue Ribbon went out of business, the box company might too. So the box man became our bag man, forking over 50 crisp $100 bills. Giampietro then raced back to the factory and doled out everyone's pay, in cash, like Jimmy Stewart keeping the Bailey Brothers building and loan afloat. Hayes lumbered into my office.
"Holland says we need to get our asses down to the bank. Pronto."
Next thing I knew, we were all sitting in a conference room at the Bank of California. On one side of the table were Holland and 2 nameless men in suits. They looked like undertakers. On the other side were Hayes and I. Holland, somber, opened.
"Gentlemen?"
"Not good," I thought.
"Gentlemen," I said.
"Gentlemen Perry, it's us."
"Gentlemen, we've decided we no longer want your business at this bank."
Hayes and I stared.
"Does that mean you're throwing us out?" Hayes asked.
"It does indeed," Holland said.
"You can't do that," Hayes said.
"We can, and we are," Holland said.
"We're freezing your funds, and we will no longer honor any more checks you write on this account."
"Freezing our..."
"I don't believe this," Hayes said.
"Believe it," Holland said.
I said nothing.
I wrapped my arms around my torso and thought, "This isn't good. This isn't good. This isn't good." Never mind the embarrassment, the hassles, the cascade of bad consequences that would follow if Holland threw us out. All I could think of was Nisho. How would they react? How would Ito react? I pictured myself telling the Iceman that we couldn't give him his $1 million. It chilled me down to my marrow. I don't remember the end of that meeting. I don't remember leaving the bank or walking out or going across the street or getting on the elevator or riding it to the top floor. I only recall shaking, violently shaking, as I asked for a word with Mr. Ito. The next thing I recall is Ito and Sumeragi taking Hayes and me into their conference room. They could sense that we were fragile. They led us to chairs, and they both looked at the floor as I spoke. K. Much K. Well, I said, I have some bad news. Our bank has thrown us out. Ito looked up. Why? He said. His eyes hardened, but his voice was surprisingly soft. I thought of the wind atop Mount Fuji. I thought of the gentle breeze stirring the ginkgo leaves in the Meiji Gardens. I said, Mr. Ito, do you know how the big trading companies and banks live on the float? Okay, we at Blue Ribbon tend to do that too from time to time, including last month. And the fact of the matter is, sir, well, we missed the float. And now the Bank of California has decided to kick us out. Sumeragi lit a cigarette. One puff. Two. Ito did the same. One puff. Two. But on the exhale, the smoke didn't seem to come from his mouth. It seemed to emanate from deep down inside him, to curl from his cuffs and shirt collar. He looked into my eyes. He bored into me. They should not have done that, he said. My heart stopped mid-beat. This was an almost sympathetic thing for Ito to say. I looked at Hayes. I looked back at Ito. I allowed myself to think, we might just get away with this. Then I realized that I hadn't yet told him the bad part. Be that as it may, I said, they did throw us out, Mr. Ito. They did. And the net-net is that I have no bank, and thus I have no money. And I need to make payroll. And I need to pay my other creditors. And if I can't meet those obligations, I am out of business. Today. In which case, not only can I not pay you the $1 million I owe you, sir, but I need to ask to borrow another $1 million. Ito and Sumeragi slid their eyes toward each other for one half second, then slid them back to me. Everything in the room came to a stop. The dust motes, the molecules of air paused mid-flight. Mr. Knight, Ito said, before giving you another cent, I will need to look at your books. When I got home from Nisho, it was about 9 p.m. Penny said Holland had phoned. Holland, I said? Yes, she said. He left instructions that you should call whenever you got home. He left his home number. He answered on the first ring. His voice was off. He'd been stiff earlier in the day while carrying out orders from his bosses, but now he sounded more like a human being. A sad, stressed human being. Phil, he said, I feel I ought to tell you, we've had to notify the FBI. I gripped the phone tighter. Say that again, I whispered. Say that again, Perry. We had no choice. What are you telling me? Well, it looks to us like fraud. I went into the kitchen and fell into a chair. What is it? Penny said. I told her. Bankruptcy, scandal, ruin, the works. Is there no hope? She asked. It's all up to Nisho. Tom Sumeragi? And his bosses. No problem, then. Sumeragi loves you. She stood. She had faith. She was completely ready for whatever may come. She even managed to turn in. Not me. I sat up all night, playing out 100 different scenarios, castigating myself for taking such a risk. When I finally crawled into bed, my mind wouldn't stop. Lying in the dark, I thought over and over, am I going to jail? Me? Jail? I got up, poured myself a glass of water, checked on the boys. They were both sprawled on their tummies, dead to the world. What would they do? What would become of them? Then I went into the den and researched the homestead laws. I was relieved to learn that the feds couldn't take the house. They could take everything else, but not this little 1,600-square-foot sanctuary. I sighed, but the relief didn't last. I started thinking about my life. I scrolled back years, questioning every decision I'd ever made that led to this point. If only I'd been better at selling encyclopedias, I thought, everything would be different. I tried to give myself the standard catechism. What do you know? But I didn't know anything. Sitting in my recliner, I wanted to cry out, I know nothing. I'd always had an answer, some kind of answer to every problem. But this moment, this night, I had no answers. I got up, found a yellow legal pad, started making lists. But my mind kept drifting. When I looked down at the pad, there were only doodles. Check marks, squiggles, lightning bolts. In the eerie glow of the moon, they all looked like angry, defiant swooshes. Don't go to sleep one night. What you most want will come to you then. I managed to fall asleep for an hour or two, and spent most of that bleary Saturday morning on the phone, reaching out to people for advice. Everyone seemed to agree that Monday would be the critical day, perhaps the most critical day of my life. We would need to act swiftly and boldly. So to prepare, I organized a summit for Sunday afternoon. We all gathered in the conference room at Blue Ribbon. There was Woodell, who must have caught the first flight out of Boston, and Hayes, and Strasser, and Kale flew up from Los Angeles. Someone brought donuts. Someone sent out for pizzas. Someone dialed Johnson and put him on the speakerphone. The mood in the room at first was somber, because that was my mood. But having my friends around, my team, made me feel better, and as I lightened up, they did too. We talked long into the evening, and if we agreed on anything, we agreed there wasn't an easy solution. There usually isn't when the FBI has been notified. Or when you've been ousted by your bank for the second time in 5 years. As the summit drew to a close, the mood shifted again. The air in the room grew stale, heavy. The pizza looked like poison. A consensus formed. The resolution of this crisis, whatever it might be, is in the hands of others. And of all those others, Nisho was our best hope. We discussed tactics for Monday morning. That's when the men from Nisho were due to arrive. Ito and Sumeragi were going to pour through our books, and while there was no telling what they might think of our finances, one thing was pretty much preordained. They were going to see right away that we'd used a big chunk of their financing not to purchase shoes from overseas, but to run a secret factory in Exeter. Best case, this would make them mad. Worst case, it would make them lose their minds. If they considered our accounting sleight of hand a full-fledged betrayal, they would abandon us faster than the bank had, in which case we'd be out of business. Simple as that. We talked about hiding the factory from them. But everyone around the table agreed that we needed to play this one straight. As in the Onitsuka trial, full disclosure, total transparency was the only course. It made sense strategically and morally. Throughout this summit, the phones rang constantly. Creditors from coast to coast were trying to find out what was going on, why our checks were bouncing like Super Bowls. Two creditors in particular were livid. One was Bill Shesky, head of Bostonian Shoes. We owed him a cool $500,000, and he wanted to let us know that he was boarding a plane and coming to Oregon to get it. The second was Bill Manowitz, head of Mano International, a trading company in New York. We owed him $100,000, and he, too, was coming to Oregon to force a showdown and to cash out. After the summit adjourned, I was the last to leave. Alone, I staggered out to my car. In my lifetime, I had finished many races on sore legs, gimpy knees, zero energy, but that night, I wasn't altogether sure I had the strength to drive home. Ito and Sumeragi were right on time. Monday morning, 9 a.m., sharp, they pulled up to the building, each wearing a dark suit and dark tie, each carrying a black briefcase. I thought of all the samurai movies I'd seen, all the books I'd read about ninjas. This was how it always looked before the ritual killing of the bad shogun.
They walked straight through our lobby and into our conference room and sat down. Without a word of small talk, we stacked our books in front of them. Sumeragi lit a cigarette. Ito uncapped a fountain pen. They commenced. Pecking at calculators, scratching at legal pads, drinking bottomless cups of coffee and green tea, they slowly peeled back the layers of our operation and peered inside. I walked in and out every 15 minutes or so to ask if they needed anything. They never did. The bank auditor arrived soon after to collect all our cash receipts. A $50,000 check from United Sporting Goods really had been in the mail. We showed him. It was right on Carol Field's desk. This was the late check that set all the dominoes in motion. This, plus the day's normal receipts, covered our shortfall. The bank auditor telephoned United Sporting Goods Bank in Los Angeles and asked that their account be charged immediately, the funds transferred to our account at Bank of California. The Los Angeles bank said no. There were insufficient funds in the United Sporting Goods account. United Sporting Goods had also been playing the float. Already feeling a splitting headache coming on, I walked back into the conference room. I could smell it in the air. We'd reached that fateful moment. Leaning over the books, Ito realized what he was looking at and did a slow double take. Exeter. Secret Factory. Then I saw the realization dawn that he was the sucker who'd paid for it. He looked up at me and pushed his head forward on his neck as if to say, "Really?" I nodded. And then he smiled. It was only a half smile, a mohair sweater smile, but it meant everything. I gave him a weak half smile in return, and in that brief wordless exchange, countless fates and futures were decided. Past midnight, Ito and Sumeragi were still there, still busy with their calculators and legal pads. When they finally left for the day, they promised to return early the next morning. I drove home and found Penny waiting up. We sat in the dining room talking. I gave her an update. We agreed that Nisha was done with their audit. They'd known everything they needed to know before lunch. What followed, and was yet to follow, was simply punishment. "Don't let them push you around like this," Penny said. "Are you kidding?" I said. "Right now they can push me around all they want. They're my only hope." "At least there are no more surprises," she said. "Yes," I said. "No more shoes to drop." Ito and Sumeragi were back at 9 a.m. the next morning and took up their places in the conference room. I went around the office and told everyone, "It's almost over. Just hang on just a little longer. There's nothing else for them to find." Not long after they arrived, Sumeragi stood, stretched, and looked as if he was going to step outside for a smoke. He motioned to me. "A word?" We walked down the hall to my office. "I fear this audit is worse than you realize," he said. "What? Why?" I said. "Because," he said, "I delayed. I sometimes did not put invoices through right away." "You did what now?" I said. Hangdog, Sumeragi explained that he'd been worried about us, that he'd tried to help us manage our credit problems by hiding Nisho's invoices in a drawer. He'd held them back, not sent them on through to his accounting people until he felt we had enough cash to pay for them, which in turn made it appear on the Nisho books that their credit exposure to us was much lower than it actually was. In other words, all this time we'd been stressing about paying Nisho on time, and we were never paying them on time, because Sumeragi wasn't invoicing us on time, thinking he was helping. "This is bad," I said to Sumeragi. "Yes," he said. "Is bad, Buck. Is very, very bad." I marched him back to the conference room, and together we told Ito, who was, of course, appalled. At first he suspected Sumeragi of acting at our behest. I couldn't blame him. A conspiracy was the most logical explanation. In his place, I would have thought the same thing. But Sumeragi, who looked as if he was about to fall to his knees before Ito, swore on his life that he'd been acting independently, that he'd gone rogue. "Why you do such a thing?" Ito demanded.
Because I think Blue Ribbon could be great success, Sumeragi said. Maybe $20 million account. I shake hands many times with Mr. Steve Prefontaine. I shake hands with Mr. Bill Bowerman. I go many times to Trailblazer Game with Mr. Phil Knight. I even pack orders at warehouse. Nike is my business child. Always it is nice to see one's business child grow.
So then, Ito said, you hide invoices because you like these men?
Deeply ashamed, Sumeragi bowed his head.
Hi, he said. Hi.
I had no idea what Ito might do, but I couldn't stick around to find out. I suddenly had another problem. My two angriest creditors had just landed. Shesky from Bostonian and Manowitz from Mano were both on the ground in Portland, headed our way. Quickly, I gathered everyone in my office and gave them their final orders. Folks, we're going to Code Red. This building, this 4,500-square-foot building, is about to be swarming with people to whom we owe money. Whatever else we do today, we cannot let any of them bump into each other. Bad enough that we owe them money. If they cross paths in the hall, if one unhappy creditor meets another unhappy creditor, and if they should have a chance to compare notes, they will freak out. They could team up and decide on some sort of collaborative payment schedule, which would be Armageddon. We drew up a plan. We assigned a person to each creditor, someone who would keep an eye on him at all times, even escorting him to the restroom. Then we assigned a person to coordinate everyone and everything, someone who would be like air traffic control, making sure the creditors and their escorts were always in separate airspace. Meanwhile, I would scurry from room to room, apologizing and genuflecting. At times, the tension was unbearable. At other times, it was a bad Marx Brothers movie. In the end, somehow, it worked. None of the creditors met any of the others. Both Shesky and Manowitz left the building that night feeling reassured, even murmuring nice things about Blue Ribbon. Nisho left a couple hours later. By then, Ito had accepted that Sumeragi was acting unilaterally, hiding invoices on his own initiative, unbeknownst to me. And he had forgiven me my sins, including my secret factory. There are worse things, he said, than ambition. Only one problem remained, and it was the problem. All else paled by comparison. The FBI. Late the next morning, Hayes and I drove downtown. We said very little in the car, very little in the elevator ride up to Nisho. We met Ito in his outer office, and he said nothing. He bowed, we bowed. Then the three of us rode the elevator silently down to the ground floor and walked across the street. For the second time in a week, I saw Ito as a mythic samurai, wielding a jeweled sword. But this time, he was preparing to defend me. If only I could count on his protection when I went to jail. The three of us walked into the Bank of California shoulder to shoulder and asked to speak with Holland. A receptionist told us to have a seat. 5 minutes passed. 10. Holland came out. He shook Ito's hand. He nodded to me and Hayes and led us into the conference room in the back, the same conference room where he'd lowered the boom days before. Holland said we were going to be joined by a Mr. So-and-so and a Mr. Such-and-such. We all sat in silence and waited for Holland's cohorts to be released from whatever crypt they were kept in. Finally, they arrived and sat on either side of him. No one was sure who should start. It was the ultimate high-stakes game, only aces are better. Ito touched his chin and decided he would open. Right away, he went all in. All fucking in. Gentlemen, he said, though he was speaking only to Holland, it is my understanding that you refuse to handle Blue Ribbon's account any longer. Holland nodded. Yes, that's right, Mr. Ito. In that case, Ito said, Nisha would like to pay off the debt of Blue Ribbon in full. Holland stared. The full. Ito looked at Holland and grunted. I glowered at Holland. I wanted to say, that's Japanese for, did I stutter? Yes, Ito said. What is the number?
Holland wrote a number on his pad and slid the paper toward Ito, who glanced quickly down.
Yes, Ito said. That is what your people have already told my people. And so.
He opened his briefcase, removed an envelope, and slid it across the table to Holland.
Here is a check for the full amount.
It will be deposited first thing in the morning, Holland said.
It will be deposited first thing today, Ito said.
Holland stammered. Okay, right, today.
The cohorts looked bewildered, terrified. Ito swiveled in his chair, took them all in with a sub-zero gaze.
There is one more thing, he said. I believe your bank has been negotiating in San Francisco to become one of Nisho's banks.
That's right, Holland said.
Ah, I must tell you that it will be a waste of your time to pursue those negotiations any further.
Are you sure? Holland asked.
I am quite sure.
The Iceman cometh. I slid my eyes toward Hayes. I tried not to smile. I tried very hard. I failed.
Then I looked right at Holland, right into the center of his eyes. He knew the bank had overplayed its hand. He knew the bank's officers had overreacted. I could see, in that moment, there would be no more FBI investigation. He and the bank wanted this matter closed, over, done with. They treated a good customer shabbily, and they didn't want to have to answer for their actions. We would never hear of them or him again. I looked at the suits on either side of Holland.
Gentlemen, I said, standing.
Gentlemen, that's business ease for take your FBI and shove it. When we were all outside the bank, I bowed to Ito. I wanted to kiss him, but I only bowed. Hayes bowed too, though for a moment I thought he was pitching forward from the stress of the last 3 days.
Thank you, I said to Ito. You will never be sorry that you defended us like that.
He straightened his tie.
Such stupidity, he said.
At first I thought he was talking about me. Then I realized he meant the bank.
I do not like stupidity, he said. People pay too much attention to numbers.
Part 2. No brilliant idea was ever born in a conference room, he assured the Dane.
But a lot of silly ideas have died there, said Starr.
F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Last Tycoon. 1975. There was no victory party. There was no victory dance. There wasn't even a quick victory jig in the halls. There wasn't time. We still didn't have a bank, and every company needs a bank. Hayes made a list of banks with the most deposits in Oregon. They were all much smaller than First National or Bank of California, but oh well, beggars, choosers, etc. The first six hung up on us. Number 7, First State Bank of Oregon, didn't. The bank was in Milwaukee, a little town half an hour up the road from Beaverton.
Come on over, said the bank president when I finally got him on the phone.
He promised me $1 million in credit, which was about his bank's limit. We moved our account that day. That night, for the first time in about 2 weeks, I put my head on a pillow and slept. The next morning, I lingered with Penny over breakfast, and we talked about the upcoming Memorial Day weekend. I told her I didn't know when I'd craved a holiday so much. I needed rest and sleep and good food, and I needed to watch pre-run. She gave me a wry smile. Always mixing business with pleasure.
Guilty.
Pre was hosting a meet that weekend in Eugene, and he'd invited the top runners in the world, including his Finnish arch-nemesis, Viren. Though Viren had pulled out at the last minute, there was still a gang of amazing runners competing, including one brash marathoner named Frank Shorter, who'd taken gold at the 1972 games in Munich, the city of his birth. Tough, smart, a lawyer now living in Colorado, Shorter was starting to become as well known as Pre, and the two were good friends. Secretly, I had designs on signing Shorter to an endorsement deal. Friday night, Penny and I drove down to Eugene and took our place with 7,000 screaming, roistering pre-fans. The 5,000-meter race was vicious, furious, and Pre wasn't at his best. Everyone could see that. Shorter led going into the last lap. But at the last possible moment and the last 200 yards, Pre did what Pre always did. He dug down deep. With Hayward vibrating and swaying from the roars and cheers, he pulled away and won in 13:23.8, which was 1.6 seconds off his best time. Pre was most famous for saying, "Somebody may beat me, but they're going to have to bleed to do it." Watching him run that final weekend of May 1975, I'd never felt more admiration for him or identified with him more closely. "Somebody may beat me," I told myself. "Some banker or creditor or competitor may stop me. But by God, they're going to have to bleed to do it." There was a post-race party at Hollister's house. Penny and I wanted to go, but we had a 2-hour drive back to Portland. The kids," we said as we waved goodbye to Pre and Shorter and Hollister. The next morning, just before dawn, the phone rang. In the dark, I groped for it. "Hello? Buck? Who's this?" "Buck, it's Ed Campbell, down at Bank of California." "Bank of Cal? Calling in the middle of the night? Surely I was having a bad dream." "Damn it, we don't bank with you anymore. You threw us out." He wasn't calling about money. He was calling, he said, because he'd heard Pre was dead. "Dead? That's impossible. We just saw him race last night." "Dead." Campbell kept repeating this word, bludgeoning me with it. "Dead, dead, dead." "Some kind of accident," he murmured. "Buck, are you there? Buck." I fumbled for the light. I dialed Hollister. He reacted just as I had. "No, it can't be. Pre was just here," he said. "He left in fine spirits. I'll call you back." When he did, minutes later, he was sobbing. As best anyone could tell, Pre drove Shorter home from the party, and minutes after dropping Shorter off, he'd lost control of his car. That beautiful butterscotch MG, bought with his first Blue Ribbon paycheck, hit some kind of boulder along the road. The car spun high into the air, and Pre flew out. He landed on the ground, and the MG came crashing down onto his chest. He'd had a beer or two at the party, but everyone who saw him leave swore that he'd been sober. He was 24 years old. He was the exact age I'd been when I left with Carter for Hawaii. In other words, when my life began. At 24, I didn't yet know who I was, and Pre not only knew who he was, the world knew. He died holding every American distance record from 2,000 meters to 10,000 meters, from 2 miles to 6 miles. Of course, what he really held, what he'd captured and kept and now would never let go of, was our imaginations. In his eulogy, Bowerman talked about Pre's athletic feats, of course, but insisted that Pre's life and his legend were about larger, loftier things. "Yes," Bowerman said, "Pre was determined to become the best runner in the world, but he wanted to be so much more. He wanted to break the chains placed on all runners by petty bureaucrats and bean counters. He wanted to smash the silly rules holding back amateur athletes and keeping them poor, preventing them from realizing their potential." As Bowerman finished, as he stepped from the podium, I thought he looked much older, almost feeble. Watching him walk unsteadily back to his chair, I couldn't conceive how he'd ever found the strength to deliver those words. Penny and I didn't follow the cortege to the ceremony. We couldn't. We were too overwrought. We didn't talk to Bowerman either, and I don't know that I ever talked to him thereafter about Pre's death. Neither of us could bear it. Later I heard that something was happening at the spot where Pre died. It was becoming a shrine. People were visiting it every day, leaving flowers, letters, notes, gifts, Nikes. Someone should collect it all, I thought, keep it in a safe place. I recalled the many holy sites I'd visited in 1962.
I thought of the Ganges, the Parthenon, Wat Prakau. Someone needed to curate Pri's rock, and I decided that someone needed to be us. We didn't have money for anything like that, but I talked it over with Johnson and Woodell, and we agreed that, as long as we were in business, we'd find money for things like that. 1976. Now that we'd gotten past our bank crisis, now that I was reasonably sure of not going to jail, I could go back to asking the deep questions. What are we trying to build here? What kind of company do we want to be? Like most companies, we had role models. Sony, for instance. Sony was the Apple of its day. Profitable, innovative, efficient, and it treated its workers well. When pressed, I often said I wanted Nike to thrive, to be a success, to be like Sony. At root, however, I still aimed and hoped for something bigger and vaguer. I searched my mind and heart, and the only thing I could come up with was this word, winning. It wasn't much, but it was far, far better than the alternative. Whatever happened, I just didn't want to lose. Losing was death. Blue Ribbon was my third child, my business child, as Sumeragi said, and I simply couldn't bear the idea of it dying. It has to live, I told myself. It just has to. That's all I know. Several times in those first months of 1976, I huddled with Hayes and Woodell and Strasser, and over sandwiches and sodas, we'd kick around this question of ultimate goals, this question of winning. Money wasn't our aim, we agreed. Money wasn't our end game. But whatever our aim or end, money was the only means to get there. More money than we had on hand. Nisha was loaning us millions, and that relationship felt sound, solidified by the recent crisis. Best partners you'll ever have. Chuck Robinson had been right, but to keep up with demand, to continue growing, we needed millions more. Our new bank was loaning us money, which was good, but because they were a small bank, we'd already reached their legal limit. At some point in those 1976 Woodell Strasser Hayes discussions, we started to talk about the most logical arithmetical solution, which was also the most difficult one emotionally. Going public. On one level, of course, the idea made perfect sense. Going public would generate a ton of money in a flash. But it would also be highly perilous, because going public often meant losing control. It could mean working for someone else, suddenly being answerable to stockholders, hundreds or maybe thousands of strangers, many of whom would be large investment firms. Going public could turn us overnight into the thing we loathed, the thing we'd spent our lives running from. For me, there was an added consideration, a semantic one. Defined by shyness, intensely private, I found that phrase itself off-putting. Going public, no thank you. And yet, during my nightly run, I'd sometimes ask myself, hasn't your life been a kind of search for connection? Running for Bowerman, backpacking around the world, starting a company, marrying Penny, assembling this band of brothers at Blue Ribbon's core? Hasn't it all been about, one way or another, going public? In the end, however, I decided, we decided, going public wasn't right. It's just not for us, I said. And we said, no way, never. Meeting adjourned. So we set about casting for other ways to raise money. One way found us. First State Bank asked us to apply for a $1 million loan, which the U.S. Small Business Administration would then guarantee. It was a loophole, a way for a small bank to gently expand its credit line, because their guaranteed loan limits were greater than their direct loan limits. So we did it, mainly to make their life easier. As is always the case, the process turned out to be more complicated than it first appeared. First State Bank and the Small Business Administration required that Bowerman and I, as majority shareholders, both personally guarantee the loan. We'd done that at First National and at Bank of California, so I didn't see a problem. I was in hock up to my neck. What was one more guarantee? Bowerman, however, balked.
retired, living on a fixed income, dispirited after the traumas of the last few years, and greatly weakened by the death of Pree. He didn't want any more risk. He feared losing his mountain. Rather than give his personal guarantee, he offered to give me 2/3 of his stake in Blue Ribbon at a discounted price. He was bowing out. I didn't want this. Never mind that I didn't have the money to buy his stake. I didn't want to lose the cornerstone of my company, the anchor of my psyche. But Bowerman was adamant, and I knew better than to argue. So we both went to Jaqua and asked him to help broker the deal. Jaqua was still Bowerman's best friend, but I'd come to think of him as a close friend, too. I still trusted him completely. "Let's not fully dissolve the partnership," I said to him. Though I reluctantly agreed to buy Bowerman's stake, low payments spread over 5 years, I begged him to retain a percentage, stay on as a vice president and a member of our small board. "Deal," he said. We all shook hands. While we were busy moving around stakes and dollars, the dollar itself was hemorrhaging value. It was all at once in a death spiral against the Japanese yen. Coupled with rising Japanese labor rates, this was now the most imminent threat to our existence. We'd increased and diversified sources of production. We'd added new factories in New England and Puerto Rico. But we were still doing nearly all our manufacturing in volatile Japan, mostly at Nippon Rubber. A sudden, crippling shortage of supply was a real possibility, especially given the spike in demand for Bowerman's waffle trainer. With its unique outer sole and its pillowy midsole cushion and its below market price, $24.95, the waffle trainer was continuing to capture the popular imagination like no previous shoe. It didn't just feel different or fit different, it looked different, radically so. Bright red upper, fat white swoosh, it was a revolution in aesthetics. Its look was drawing hundreds of thousands of new customers into the Nike fold, and its performance was sealing their loyalty. It had better traction and cushioning than anything on the market. Watching that shoe evolve in 1976 from popular accessory to cultural artifact, I had a thought. People might start wearing this thing to class, and the office, and the grocery store, and throughout their everyday lives. It was a rather grandiose idea. Adidas had had limited success converting athletic shoes to everyday wear, with the Stan Smith tennis shoe and the country running shoe, but neither was nearly as distinctive or popular as the waffle trainer. So I ordered our factories to start making the waffle trainer in blue, which would go better with jeans, and that's when it really took off. We couldn't make enough. Retailers and sales reps were on their knees, pleading for all the waffle trainers we could ship. The soaring pair counts were transforming our company, not to mention the industry. We were seeing numbers that redefined our long-term goals, because they gave us something we'd always lacked, an identity. More than a brand, Nike was now becoming a household word, to such an extent that we would have to change the company name. Blue Ribbon, we decided, had run its course. We would have to incorporate as Nike Incorporated. And for this newly named entity to stay vibrant, to keep growing, to survive the declining dollar, we'd need, as always, to ramp up production. Sales reps on their knees, that wasn't sustainable. We'd need to find more manufacturing hubs outside Japan. Our existing factories in America and Puerto Rico would help, but they weren't nearly enough. Too old, too few, too expensive. So in the spring of 1976, it was finally time to turn to Taiwan. For our point man in Taiwan, I looked to Jim Gorman, a valued employee, long known for his almost fanatical loyalty to Nike. Raised in a series of foster homes, Gorman seemed to find in Nike the family he'd never had, and thus he was always a good sport, always a team player. It was Gorman, for instance, who'd drawn the miserable task of driving Kitami to the airport back in 1972, after that final showdown in Jaqua's conference room. And he did it without complaint. It was Gorman who'd taken over the Eugene store from Waddell, the toughest of acts to follow. It was Gorman who wore subpar Nike spikes in the 1972 Olympic trials. In every instance, Gorman had done a fine job and never uttered a sour word.
He seemed the perfect candidate to take on the latest mission impossible, Taiwan. But first, I'd need to give him a crash course on Asia. So I scheduled a trip, just the two of us. On the flight overseas, Gorman proved to be an avid student, a virtual sponge. He grilled me about my experiences, my opinions, my reading, and wrote down every word I said. I felt as if I were back in school, teaching at Portland State, and I liked it. I remembered that the best way to reinforce your knowledge of a subject is to share it, so we both benefited from my transferring everything I knew about Japan, Korea, China, and Taiwan to Gorman's brain. Shoe producers, I told him, are abandoning Japan en masse, and they're all landing in two places, Korea and Taiwan. Both countries specialize in low-price footwear, but Korea had elected to go with a few giant factories, whereas Taiwan is building 100 smaller ones. So that's why we're choosing Taiwan. Our demand is too high, our volume too low for the biggest factories. And in smaller factories, we'll have the dominant position. We'll be in charge. Of course, the tougher challenge was to get any factory we chose to upgrade its quality. And then there was the constant threat of political instability. President Chiang Kai-shek had just died, I told Gorman, and after 25 years in command, he was leaving a nasty power vacuum. For good measure, you always need to account for Taiwan's ancient tensions with China. On and on I talked as we sailed over the Pacific. While taking copious notes, Gorman also came up with new, fresh ideas, which gave me new insights, things to think about. As we stepped off the plane in Taichung, our first stop, I was delighted and impressed. This guy was intense, energetic, eager to get started. I was proud to be his mentor. Good choice, I told myself. By the time we reached the hotel, however, Gorman was pea green. Taichung looked and smelled like the far end of the galaxy, a vast megalopolis of smoking factories and thousands of people per square foot. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen, and I'd been all over Asia, so of course it overwhelmed poor Gorman. I saw in his eyes that typical first-timer's reaction to Asia, that look of alienation and circuit overload. He looked exactly like Penny when she met me in Japan. Steady, I told him, take it one day, one factory at a time. Follow your mentor's lead. Over the next week, we visited and toured about 24 factories. Most were bad. Dark, dirty, with workers going through the motions, heads bowed, vacant looks in their eyes. Just outside Taichung, however, in the small town of Doliu, we found a factory that showed promise. It was called Feng Te, and it was managed by a young man named C.H. Wong. Small but clean, it had a positive vibe, as did Wong, a shoe dog who lived for his workplace, and in it. When we noticed that one small room off the factory floor was off limits, I asked what was in there. Home, he said. That is where my wife and I and our three kids live. I was reminded of Johnson. I decided to make Feng Te the cornerstone of our Taiwan effort. When we weren't touring factories, Gorman and I were being feted by factory owners. They stuffed us with local delicacies, some of which were actually cooked, and plied us with something called Mao Tai, which was a Mai Tai, but apparently with shoe cream instead of rum. Jet-lagged, Gorman and I both had lost our tolerance. After two Mao Tais, we were blasted. We tried to slow down, but our hosts kept raising their glasses. To Nike! To America! At the final dinner of our Taichung visit, Gorman repeatedly excused himself and ran to the men's room to splash cold water on his face. Every time he left the table, I got rid of my Mao Tai by pouring it into his water glass. Each time he returned from the men's room, there was another toast, and Gorman thought he was playing it safe by raising his water glass. To our American friends! To our Taiwanese friends! After another huge gulp of spiked water, Gorman looked at me, panic-stricken. I think I'm going to pass out, he said. Have some more water, I said. Tastes funny. Nah. Despite offloading my booze onto Gorman, I was woozy when I got back to my room. I had trouble getting ready for bed. I had trouble finding the bed.
I fell asleep while brushing my teeth, mid-brush. I woke sometime later and tried to find my extra contact lenses. I found them, then dropped them on the floor. There was a knock. Gorman. He walked in and asked me